I'm Kieran.
And I'm Eve. This is Kitchen Table Cult.
We're two quiverful escapees talk about our experiences in the cultish underbelly of the religious right. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Kieran. We've tried to restart this recording three times. Hopefully this one will take. How are you?
I am doing better. So the last episode that was released, at the end, I started coming down with a cold or really bad allergies or something. And I have been so congested for the last 2 weeks, but I think I'm done now.
Yeah, we've postponed recording this three times because you didn't have a voice, and I'm glad you're back.
Yeah, me too. It's nice. I didn't know. I've gone through five boxes of tissues. I don't know how I had that much mucus in my body, but it's gone now. So hopefully my body is satisfied with
that
its job.
That is an upsetting factoid.
Yeah. I mean, they weren't. So the tissue box sizes here are different. They're a little bit smaller.
Okay.
So they're half size, but still.
So three Costco size Kleenexes?
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, so it's still upsetting, but it's not as upsetting as it would otherwise be.
I would like to apologize if I lose my voice or get super crunchy here. I am congested today, but that's because yard work has begun in earnest. The garden is happening, and I was moving these, we had so much Bermuda grass last summer that we pulled out of our front yard. And it's just been rotting on the side yard in a pile, decomposing. And I was moving it yesterday, and it was just this entire dust clouds of mold spores in my face. So I'm heavily medicated here. I've got some tea, and hopefully it'll, be fine. But ooh, I can feel that.
Spring is here. Trees are having sex in the air. And it is your annual reminder to get your Gebärmutterhöhle checked, apparently.
Your what?
Your Gebärmutterhöhle, which is the German way of saying uterus. It literally translates to give birth hole. Give birth mother hole. So
good.
It's if you haven't gotten your pap smear yet, according to my partner's German health insurance, it is time to do so.
I'm glad that they make sure they send that to all the trans ladies.
Yeah, it's great. It's the first time I haven't gotten one, and I was confused for a minute, and then I remembered that I changed the gender on my passport, so Germany only knows me as someone who does not have a uterus. So I'm
you don't have a mother hole.
I don't have a becoming mother hole. I'm just waiting to get one about getting my prostate checked or something, and then I'll have. They sent this handy little pamphlet that has this great illustration.
You do grow a prostate, basically, don't you? That's what I understood.
I mean, I don't know that the science is definitive on that yet. I haven't discovered it. But who knows? When it's time for me to get my prostate checked, maybe we'll find out and I'll get a handy little diagram about what that looks like in German.
Fun fact, going back to the trees having sex, and since we're all on this, just for fun, if you don't know why we have such a pollen issue, it's because city planners were we don't want fruits on our streets, so we're just going to plant dude trees. And so we've had these lonely boys jizzing in the air for a couple decades with nowhere to go.
Because
city planners thought it would be smart.
And all these city planners are likely dudes as well. So it tracks all the way down. That's so upsetting.
Yeah. So anyway, fun fact. You want to know why you can't breathe right now?
It's Blame your city planner.
It's probably a city planner's fault.
How rude.
Speaking of reproductive systems.
I know. I was there are so many fun ways to make this transition.
That's all we're talking about today. I'm so excited. As I said, we've been trying to record this for 3 weeks. And we've had some thoughts on the Alabama IVF ruling and its aftermath.
Yeah. So I think it's probably best to start off at like the top, which is what is IVF and how does it work? And then we can get into like the interesting things about the rhetoric and the ruling and the implications. But like, right. Who even knows what IVF is?
Not city planners, obviously.
No.
So I think it's really interesting to be having these like conversations about the anti-choice pro-life like movement around IVF and how it's not a united front like on abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And it all kind of comes down to like what IVF is and how it works and their understanding of those mechanisms. When do you first remember like hearing IVF being discussed?
It was in the late 90s, I think, because I remember hearing about it when I was a child. And I remember, I don't remember which news story this was, but I remember hearing about a story of like a woman who had a ton of babies because she had in vitro fertilization, which is what IVF stands for.
You're talking about John and Kate plus eight, those folks, the octuplets.
Oh, maybe. I don't remember who it was. I just remembered hearing about it and being confused about how that works. And then that was when I learned about in vitro fertilization and like the complicated thing that is.
That might have been my introduction to it too. I don't remember when it first came up. I do remember a lot of like God's World News, which is a kids' version of World Magazine, talking about cloning.
Oh yeah, that too.
And Dolly the Sheep, and like that being like a pro-life discourse, like being problematic. And that was like 97 or something.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it was like the Gosling octuplets, I think that's their last name, being in the tabloids and seeing that at the supermarket checkout stand and like seeing those displays and like being like confused about how this works. I do have a very vivid memory of like going down a research rabbit hole on like high number pregnancies occurring naturally and like discovering in the Guinness Book of World Records that there was a woman in Russia who had like 60 kids.
Oh, I remember hearing about that too and being like, wow.
Individually.
That's too many. I was like, how does that even math? Like,
the math was really rough.
Body,
but yeah. Yeah, I remember finding that out and being like horrified by that. Yeah.
So what is in vitro fertilization and how does it work before we get into the like interesting nuances of how it's treated?
Yeah. So basically it's, you know, you're stimulating the follicles in the ovaries to mass produce a bunch of eggs that you're able to extract. And that is an incredibly like painful and intense process. Like you have to be giving yourself hormone injections for weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And you are like, imagine your like normal premenstrual mood shifts and side effects and cramping and bloating and all of that. Like, but like, because you're on so many hormones, it's like it's amplified. It's really, really intense. And then the eggs are extracted and then they're fertilizing them in a lab.
Mm-hmm. In a petri dish, allegedly.
Yeah, in a petri dish, allegedly. We were homeschooled. We don't know how that science actually works.
Yeah.
what the correct terminology of the tools is.
They mix it together like soup. They wait for it to become fertilized and then inject it back into
the, well, yes,
and the Gebärmutter, and Mutterhola.
Part of the process is like a lot of the reason to do that is that you have a genetic, you know, problems. So like you might have chromosomal disorders that would show up in like a large percentage of your pregnancies. So you're like trying to, you know, make sure you don't have like a baby that can't actually live post-birth. Mm-hmm. And like selecting out for the ones that are like definitely not viable. And we're not even going to go into the like designer babies, like more eugenicist stuff, but this is, I'm talking about like very specifically the stuff that would make an infant unable to live. Mm-hmm. And they're selecting out for that. There's obviously more things they can select out for, but it originally was more trying to just like up the odds of how many implanted embryos would survive. Mm-hmm. And so they're selecting out of that. And because the odds of implantation, which we should talk about, are low. They're so low. They're putting multiple in at a time because it is very likely that only one of several will take, if any of them take. Yeah, so we should like back up and like talk about hormonal birth control, shouldn't we?
Yeah. Yes, we should actually, because that kind of sets the stage for a lot of this, because
all the logic behind why IVF is a problem comes back to misunderstandings about hormonal birth control.
Yep. Yeah, because I remember we both had anxiety about whether or not our like normal non-medicated cycles were aborting babies. And like, you know, obviously not, because one, that's not how it works, and two, we weren't having sex, but like this this idea is not uncommon, and the way that the, you know, Christian worldview we grew up in understands birth control is that it is abortive, which is false, and therefore that's bad, but that's not at all how it works. And you did a bunch of research on this.
the term abortifacient is like thrown around a lot and caused me personally a lot of like dyslexic angst, because it's very difficult to spell or say correctly, and was used a lot in these circles. So like when you and I first got out of fundamentalism, we watched a lot of our peers leave it because they started having kids and they realized they didn't want to discipline their kids the way they had been treated as kids. Mm-hmm. So for a lot of people, that was their like opening for getting out. In terms of the theology stuff, like a lot of the stuff that we like started questioning beyond all the obvious like child abuse and covering that up and marital rape and domestic violence and all of that, was when we realized that hormonal birth control did not work the way we had been told it worked. Mm-hmm. So I remember being a newlywed and writing this blog post that like had so many of my friends mad at me because I was like, oh shit, this didn't work the way I thought it did. And it actually became like a really big conflict in my marriage. How were you taught that hormonal birth control worked?
I mean, I was just taught that it aborted babies, like straight up. Like that was about the end of the conversation. And it wasn't until I like started researching on scarlatine that I realized that like it prevents pregnancy by doing all of the work of making it like a hostile environment for like an egg to be fertilized to begin with before you even get to the point of being pregnant.
Right.
Which was the opposite of how I was led to believe these things worked.
So what we were taught was like, or what I was taught, was that birth control creates an environment where a fertilized egg cannot implant, which I still believe is true. But we were taught that that was a problem because the understanding was that fertilized eggs always implant. Mm-hmm. And so this was creating a loss of potential life at a higher rate than you would without it, which is factually very not true. The reason this was an issue in my marriage, and I'll just give the whole story because I think it's interesting, was once I found out the actual science, I understood that without any hormonal birth control intervention, 78% of fertilized eggs never implant anyway or do not successfully implant, and so are not going to lead to a pregnancy. If you're like dealing with maximum fertility situation, mm-hmm. that's the chance that you're not going to have a fertilized egg implant and become a pregnancy. So having that be like the default, having hormonal birth control as an intervention actually means that you're losing fewer fertilized eggs,
yeah.
potential embryos. So it's actually more pro-life if you believe that fertilization is the start of life, mm-hmm. to be using hormonal birth control because the loss
you're saving them.
Rate is lower.
Yeah.
Yeah. This broke my brain. So obviously, I didn't want to have kids right away. I hadn't really figured out what I wanted. I just knew that I needed a break. And we had this whole thing. And actually, I was like researching this for the book and like realized it was a bigger deal than I thought it was. We had this whole thing about like we weren't going to have kids until student loans were paid off. And so like that was why we were using birth control. I thought it was just because I needed a break, which I did. But I realized that that was an additional piece mm-hmm. of the puzzle. I guess I have to thank Dave Ramsey for that.
Ew.
Dave Ramsey kept me from having kids. Whoops. That's a really awkward realization.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I know. I have to go back and like update that piece. But my ex-husband disagreed with my analysis of the science. I can't remember if he read the same stuff, if I sent him the research I had found, and like he just was like,
ignored it.
This is not definitive enough. I don't feel comfortable trusting it, or if he didn't read it, but he just was not comfortable with it. So he wanted to be sure that there was no chance of losing a potentially fertilized egg.
So let's go back to the 78% of likelihood of losing the fertilized egg.
What our compromise was, and this was on his insistence, was that me having ADHD, if I missed a dose of my pill, which happened a lot, and we had had sex. I think it was if I had missed two pills in a row. I think that was the line. So if I missed two doses in a row and we had sex on like day two, then mm-hmm. I would have to then, and if it, you know, obviously it wasn't on my period or whatever, if it was in the other phases yeah. of the cycle, I would then have to go off of birth control until I got my period and stop taking it. And then I would restart it after my period. Which is a legitimately insane thing to do now that I know how much hormones impact mental health.
Yeah.
Like, no wonder I was an anxious mess.
Yeah, yeah. No, that... Like,
all other things aside, trauma, family history of these issues, but like, holy shit, I was not playing on easy mode.
No.
And so I was like... writing about this decision, this compromise. I don't even know if I like got into what we ended up deciding, but just like I remember being like, I need to share that the science is different than what I thought it was. And like, I think it's actually more pro-life to be on the pill until you want to have a kid. And people were pissed. I had like people like take me out to like talk to me and be like, I'm very uncomfortable with what you wrote.
Wow.
Because, you know, the culture of accountability stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Was such that it was appropriate. So this was a whole thing, and this was a very common teaching in our community. So when we look at IVF and you're seeing like, okay, they implant 4 embryos and like 3 don't make it, like that obviously raises the same red flags.
Because, and this is like the crux of the issue that ties birth control and IVF together. They believe that life begins at conception. So like the second an egg is fertilized, they believe that is a full-fledged like human baby and not an embryo with 9 months in which any number of things could go wrong and you don't wind up with a person at the end. It's as soon as an egg is fertilized, then it becomes a whole ass human baby with like fingers and nails and all that shit.
And this is a relatively new belief because it historically, like Christians would date everything from quickening, which is when the host of the pregnancy feels the first movement, from the fetus. So that would be like considered like the start of life in historically by some folks. And then other folks, and this goes back into the history of Judaism, it's like when the newborn takes its first breath. And so that would be when life was considered to have started. So like all of these, you know, these conversations that come back to those like week bans, you know, the 16-week ban, like they're, a lot of them are coming at this with that in mind. Like, I think part of the logic for the initiating these, like, okay, no abortions after 20 weeks. Like that original line, I think was around the concept of quickening. And then the, you know, like conversations about late term abortion. Like, anyway, we don't need to go down that road, but the fact of the matter is that anyone who's seeking a late term abortion is dealing with a, either like insane logistical situation and like massive obstacles, or is needing to deal with a wanted baby that will not live, or continuing the pregnancy will deeply harm the mother.
Yeah.
So all the like the pedantic like X weeks stuff, like by the first heartbeat, like all of that comes back to like, when does life start? What is the specific belief of that?
Yeah.
And it's much less arbitrary than it sounds.
Yeah. And Alabama has codified in law when life begins as at conception, which is why they were able to do the thing that they did with the wrongful death suit, because they have already established legally that fertilized implanted embryos are, well, not, well, the question was whether or not it had to be implanted, because they already established that fertilized embryos are people.
Okay, can we like talk about what this case actually was? Like, yes. This is a legitimately bonkers case. So like whatever you think it is, if you have not looked it up, it is not what you think it is.
It took me a good staring at it to even begin to comprehend how it works. So
I was laughing my ass off for like 2 days straight over this. Like the circumstances are absurd.
So what happened?
So the term wrongful death and like a wrongful death suit, like this is a like civil suit about insurance, essentially. Like, you know, if someone is like you know, committing suicide, completing suicide, whatever. They're not able to get the insurance money.
Right.
For that situation. So, like, when you're talking about, like, damages for something, you know, your spouse is the primary breadwinner and someone, you know, accidentally hits them with the car, that's a wrong, you could, like, charge for compensation around not just, like, life insurance, but, like, you know, the standard of living you've been accustomed to, and, like, this is a wrongful death situation. You're not even, like, getting into the criminal charges of whatever happened. So this is about money and compensation and, like, what you lost. So what actually happened at the clinic?
There was, like, a break-in and somebody grabbed eggs out of the fridge and then dropped them on the floor.
Okay.
Was this,
a patient snuck into what I am imagining is like a walk-in freezer, but I don't think it is. Like, it walked into the lab where embryos are stored and they're frozen, right? They're like,
right.
They're not just like your household freezer cold. They are like deep,
like dry ice cold.
Like, they're so cold you touch gloves. It, it'll burn you. Which is exactly what happened. So this person goes in, sneaks into the freezer, grabs some vials of
barehanded,
gets burned, goes out, and drops them on the floor, and they smash. So
I have many questions.
So, like, in theoretically, you're thinking about this in terms of, like, so maybe this couple, like, froze eggs before something happened where they couldn't go back and make more.
Which is, like, a normal thing.
It's a common thing. Like, you know, someone has to have, like, yeah, like, this happens. And so the couples, like, bringing this suit against the clinic are bringing it about, like, property that was damaged, which is a very normal response. But they're not just doing it about property loss. They're doing it about, like, wrongful death. Therefore, they get more money.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question was not, are embryos life?
Right.
Does consumption start at life? But are embryos, like, people for the circumstances of how much financial compensation you're getting for losing them.
If someone drops the vial that they are in on the floor.
And there's no chance of doing this ever again. Like, this is like your only heir. And there's no chance of ever having another. And what's really interesting about the case is, like, reading it, both sides are all like, yes, the embryos are life. We do like, everybody's on board with that because everybody's fundamentalist, but they disagree on how this should be billed. what is the line item on the invoice to the clinic's insurance company for what they lost?
Yeah. Yeah. That is the only question, because, again, Alabama has already enshrined when life begins in law. So that was already established. It's just like, are we liable for the human cost? Are we liable for, like, you know,
the invested property?
Right.
How much money they spent to you know, get this property.
Right. Because it's not an inexpensive process. Like, IVF is hard and expensive. It is
no one was questioning whether or not they need the money to be reimbursed somehow. It's just how much. And I think this is, like, really interesting because this case, like, kind of exemplifies the, like, some of the spectrum of belief about IVF within the, like, conservative religious right.
Yeah.
And that's part of what makes this whole situation really interesting, is that there's not a united front. It's not abortion. They're not in step with each other yet.
No, to the point that there was so much like outrage that the Alabama legislature quickly passed a bill that would protect IVF patients and practitioners to continue to use IVF. And that got signed into law like on the inside of a week with like overwhelmingly conservative like population, because there was just so much outrage about it.
A Republican majority legislature were like, no, like we are going to not prosecute anyone who's, you know, practicing IVF and like embryos are not making it.
Right. Because, and this is where it gets interesting, because the nuances of like the different camps of like, is IVF okay? Is IVF not okay? And like where those lines are, there's so many of them.
Right. So if you're like in Texas and there's a bounty for so-and-so had an at-home, super early, self-managed abortion, does that either, like, can you rat on them for having killed an infant? That was like kind of the direction that the concern was, you know, coming up in Alabama, was like, if we lose an embryo that we implanted, is the doctor then going to be held responsible for the life of a child, according to legal terms? Mm-hmm. Like, are they a murderer of a kid? It's so funny. This whole thing is like, if it wasn't so like dire and serious and like indicative of where we're heading, it would be very hilarious. Like, it is objectively a very wacky situation.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I did some research because I wanted to know, like, you know, what the people on the right had thought about IVF over time. And I found in 2019, Wayne Grudem, who mm-hmm. all of you know, of course.
Should we explain for those who yes, don't?
Yes, no, we do totally should.
Okay. Okay, so Wayne Grudem was involved in the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, which was like stating that complementarian theology was the name of the game, and everybody was on board with how that, you know, informed viewing gender roles in the church. Mm-hmm. This is a like an evangelical movement moment, and the signers of the Council on Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, their initial statement called the Danvers Statement, happened in 1985 and was largely, you know, it's like names you would recognize, like John Piper and what's his face from the Southern Baptist Convention? Al Mohler.
Mohler, yeah.
Mohler and like
it's the MacArthur. Who's who.
Yeah, it's the who's who. Everybody who like later basically becomes the Gospel Coalition. It's just like a lot of the same people, a lot of the same community. And so it's Grudem is more in the Reformed camps. So he's not super like well known if you grew up Baptist or Pentecostal, but like if you grew up with Calvinist teaching in this world, you probably had a copy of it because he had a systematic theology book that he wrote that was for adults. And then he had a teen version.
Mm-hmm.
Or like a young adult version.
And now he has like, an online course if you feel like taking that.
Right. So if you were taking like the worldview camp stuff in the non-Calvinist universes, your worldview camps would be focused on evangelism and missions work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if it was in the Reformed camps, it would be focused on understanding like like predestination and theology.
Right.
And if you were in those circles, you were absolutely like beginning your learning journey with Grudem.
Yes.
So he's a name. And so what you're about to read from him is significant because of who he is.
Yes. Yeah. He's one of the big thought leaders in the sort of conservative Christian culture. So in 2019, he wrote, is IVF morally right? I don't remember what was happening in 2019 around IVF, but apparently it was big enough that he needed to write a whole ass article about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's a very interesting piece because his whole thing is like, yes. And then there's like a section where he goes into like the arguments against IVF. So I'm going to read a couple like segments out of it that kind of condense this whole idea.
He wrote this for the Gospel Coalition blog.
Yeah. So he said, we believe the embryo is human and a person from conception onward. Our views on the embryo's status led to our greatest moral objection to IVF, namely its waste and loss of embryonic life. If the success rate of IVF had risen to 95% or even 80 or 85%, we would be more sympathetic to it. But IVF technology is currently nowhere near such success rates. We find the loss of so much human life morally unacceptable. Success rates are, at best, only 17% when one embryo is used. Too many human lives are lost to think this is morally acceptable. And that's very condensed, one paragraph, and then continuing on. My response is that fertilizing only one egg or two at a time and implanting these with the hope that they will survive is far different from the common practice of IVF, where several eggs are fertilized and then most are intentionally destroyed. In that case, there is a willful, intentional destruction of human lives. But with the fertilization of only one or two eggs at a time, the intent of the doctor and the husband and wife is that all fertilized eggs will live and come to a normal birth. Therefore, I still think IVF without the destruction of embryos is morally acceptable.
Right. So as we talked about earlier, like IVF is such an intensely invasive process for whoever's producing the eggs, that for the sake of not putting them through that multiple times, they will pump you full of hormones so you can get multiple eggs at one go, and then they'll fertilize them all, and then you have spare embryos. And this is for the sake of efficiency, like timing. If you're older, like you want to get it done as soon as possible. You don't want those eggs to be any older than they possibly have to be. Like, there's so many reasons to do it. Like, it's very expensive to do this process. And so if you want to get the Costco pack of eggs and start popping them out from that, and if you don't use them all, then you know you can have them destroyed, you can save them, you can have it saved indefinitely and not do anything with it, you can have them be donated to stem cell research,
which is bad science, apparently,
because using the embryos for stem cell research destroys them. So that was a big thing that I remember World Magazine covering a lot, was stem cell research being bad because it killed babies.
Yep. That was where most of my like IVF adjacent learning happened, was about the stem cell research aspect of it and how that was bad because you're killing babies to get
Yeah, and oh God, and there's like, you can like draw a direct line from that conclusion to like the QAnon revival of blood libel conversation, which we've covered a lot before. So if you don't know what that is, go Google it. You'll figure it out. So what Grudem is saying is two eggs at a time. Harvest two eggs at a time, use two eggs at a time. This is the like, you want to have the, instead of going to the grocery store for all the groceries you will need for 2 weeks, you're going to the grocery store every day you need a new item.
Yeah.
In that moment, you have nothing in your pantry. You are out of bread. So you're going to go buy one serving of bread. That is functionally what he is encouraging, but on the scale of
invasive surgical procedures to have a child.
Thousands and thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of dollars every single time.
Yeah.
Like people I know who do, I mean, I'm sure a lot of you already know this because you're all adults at this point, but like, you know, we're old enough that we've had friends doing IVF, but like, I know people who are getting second mortgages to cover like two rounds of IVF. Like it's a really costly process.
Yes. But according to Raine Grudem, the only way to do it and be morally pure is to do it in the way that is more expensive, least effective, and results in lower chances of it actually working, because you're just making this go on for longer than it needs to. But that's how he and a bunch of Christian leaders who think similarly about how life begins at conception and how stem cell research is wrong and how, you know, having frozen embryos in a test tube is akin to murder. Like, that's how they justify it. And also only for cishet people.
Yeah. So there's a lot of like the history of IVF and like what the various denominations like decided their policy was going to be about it, like comes back to being uncomfortable with donor sperm or donor eggs being used, which literally had not occurred to me as a problem, but I guess that just shows how much I'm hanging out with gay people now.
Yeah.
I was like, oh yeah, that's right. They think that's cheating, don't they?
Yeah. It's then not the married couple. It's someone else. So, you know, but like, and it's different than adoption somehow, I guess, because it's one of the people in the marriage doing it.
Well, that's one of the things that they'll say is like, okay, fine. If you must get the Costco pack of embryos, you have to then donate the rest. And there are possible like situations where you can adopt embryos. It's like this like complicated legal gray area in terms of like, is it property? Is it not? How much can you get paid for it? Is it okay? Like, so, and like, again, the denominations break down and differ from each other in terms of like, is getting money for selling your unused embryos to someone who's going to use it for an adoption, you know, self-implantation, but like, this is an adopted embryo kind of thing. Is that a problem? Is that not? Like, there's not a lot of agreement theologically.
Yeah. No, but the one thing that they all agree on is that queer parents should not be allowed to do it.
Yeah.
Across the board, this can only be used inside of a Christian, this is heterosexual marriage, no gay people allowed, because the only way for a queer couple to have a baby is by surrogacy or IVF.
Right.
Or adoption.
Right. So this is, there's, you know, there's like strict like gatekeeping on cisgender, heterosexual, married access to these services, yada, yada, yada. But they all believe that like, this is a form of life, and life is important. But what they do with that conclusion is incredibly different. And this is why, like, there's not a united front here. Because is it more pro-life to have multiple embryos implanted and have a 90% chance of success, as Grudem so clearly notes? Is that more pro-life than, say, not being on birth control and having your 78%, like,
and they don't answer these questions.
They don't answer these questions. And so like, is the end goal of the child the, like the biggest good, because life is good and children are like unconditionally good. Then in that case, then like IVF has to be good. But if you're in a situation where, you know, you've had 19 rounds of IVF and you end up succeeding on your 20th, but like, what does it mean to have been at round 19 making the decision to go ahead and do round 20 and not knowing what's going to happen? The various like differences in the conservative Christian community on that, how to make that decision in that kind of situation. Like, it varies so widely.
It really, really does.
And I think this is like where we start seeing the pro-life movement beginning to fall apart, because they don't have Roe v. Wade to fight against.
Mm-hmm.
They're having to get into more nuanced technical territory that requires like understanding of basic science to have a conversation about for policy reasons. You can't just say like abortion is bad, this is why we're pro-life, end of story. Right. You have to then start discussing, is hormonal birth control an abortive tool?
Mm-hmm.
Is quickening where we say life starts? Is, you know, like if this embryo was, you know, genetically real fucked up and not going to like live more than like 3 months of a pregnancy, is that life?
Mm-hmm. Well, and even like, does a couple have the right to determine whether or not, or when or if to use birth control or like IVF or like, you know, it, and this is what they're really getting at with these court cases, mm-hmm. is the right to privacy. Like, do married couples, or even just like unmarried, like, do people have the right to determine how and when and whether or if they are going to have a child?
Yeah. If you take this to its logical end, there is like an entire like Bible passage about God smiting someone who was like contractually obligated to make a baby, and he used the pullout method, mm-hmm. and God smited him and he died because he spilled his seed on the ground. Like, we can take this, like, there's like precedent for this conversation that goes way, way, way back. And here we are like making policy off of these kinds of questions. And like, what is your obligation to potential versus what exists now or does or can exist or can't exist?
Yeah.
And what's and that's privacy like, around it?
And that's where it's going to get really interesting, because like, we know the goal is to go after access to birth control and access to reproductive care via the courts, but it is incredibly unpopular as a voting issue. Like, people don't like the idea of their, like, you know, state representatives saying they can or can't be on birth control, which is used for way more than just having children. Like, it's used to help with so many health problems. And I think that's where they're really going to struggle, because like, people, it's so unpopular.
There's a real like logic hole here, pothole here. Like, for for solidarity purposes, like within the reproductive rights movement and the trans rights movement, there needs to be like a clear understanding of birth control. Hormonal birth control is a form of HRT. Taking estrogen after menopause, your bones don't fucking turn to dust, is a form of HRT.
Yep.
Taking something hormonal to allow you to not lose your hair is a form of HRT. Like, all of these things, like, have, they overlap. They are consistently, you know, similar tools, different purposes, but like having the right to access those things,
mm-hmm.
is the same across the board. And we're starting to see, yeah, I mean, well, there's a case that's been going since 2021, I guess, now, in Texas around this question. I guess this is where we should end it. It was talking about that case.
Mm-hmm.
You want to?
The Title give the, 10 the
bare, yeah, give the bare bones of what it is.
So this dad is upset that Title 10 clinics, which are like government-funded healthcare clinics, that it's Title 10 is like a kind of grant to enable clinics for low-income people to access like reproductive care.
Family planning services.
And Planned Parenthood gets a not insignificant amount of their funding from Title 10, which is why everyone's like, oh, defund Planned Parenthood. It's defunding Title 10. But anyway.
Right, but like, you're like county health department is getting money for this to be able to like tell people, like, you know, with family planning questions or needing STI testing, like it's it's providing those kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he's upset that there is not a requirement to tell parents whether or not their child is getting prescribed birth control. And so he's suing about it.
So, Karen, does that mean this man's children have daughters have been using Title X clinics for their to access birth control?
It absolutely does not. No. Why would that be in the Doesn't world that, where 303 Creative was decided and heard entirely based on fiction? Why would it matter?
So what we're saying here is normally this kind of case would be dismissed because there's no issue of there is an issue of standing. Like, this man does not have like an actual situation that he can bring a complaint about. This is a theoretical situation, but it is being heard in the Fifth Circuit by a judge who is a former ADF dude. No, not a former ADF dude. ADF peer organization. But
and the man on the case is
an ADF
funded
lawyer.
By ADF. Well, he's not an ADF lawyer. His firm is funded by ADF.
Right. This his involvement in this case is paid for by ADF.
Yes.
He's an ADF hired gun.
Right. Exactly. The same 10 people.
The same 10 people just, you know, playing musical chairs with rather hanging out in the courts. So this judge is the same judge who was finding in favor of 303 Creative, which we talked about, and you can go on your rant now.
It's all fake. It's all based on nothing. Like, there is none of the people exist. The situation never fucking happened. Like, all the way down, 303 Creative was fake.
Friend of the pod, Melissa Girogrant, was covering this extensively as it was happening. Like, this woman was like, in the universe where I, in theory, make wedding websites, which I don't currently, I don't want to have to provide one for gay people who have never asked me to do this.
And who never would.
And never would. And therefore, I can say I'm being discriminated against. Yeah.
And the best part was that they made up a client who actually exists in California, is a web designer himself, and has been married to his wife for like ever.
For
and it's
decades.
Like, he did no research on this fictitious couple who like is a already does this.
The man named as the theoretical client was never a client because he would never be a client.
No. He has the skill already.
So this has already been, so this is a case that came up before the same judge that's hearing this case, and the same issue of standing was brought up and made irrelevant, and he ruled on it in that certain way. So we are paying attention to this.
Yeah, and not surprised that it hasn't been just dismissed out of hand as not having standing, because this dude and this court and this lawyer just like doing this shit for fun because they have nothing better to do.
And I just keep thinking about all of the situations in which a child, you know, a young adult, young teen, might be sexually active for reasons that either they need to keep their parents from knowing for physical safety, or are sexually active because of non-consensual situations that they do not have the power to change. Mm-hmm. And like all the different reasons why a teen might be accessing birth control or as birth control, not to even like begin to talk about, you know, the management of, you know, premenstrual dysphoric disorder or endometriosis or cysts or like all, a million different other things. Like, it's a very like, it's a very mean-spirited thing to bring up in addition to all the other like, this man doesn't have standing, period.
Yeah. Well, and the thing that is not really even mentioned in like the case itself is the agency of the daughters, theoretically. Right. Like, of course the daughters don't have agency over their own lives, because in the US children are still seen as property.
Right. And I remember, like, the HPV vaccine became available, and mm-hmm. we were told not to access that because, even though, like, upwards of 90% of people in this country have it or have had it, right. it's really, really common. And, like, there's so many ways you can get it that don't involve sexual activity. Like, there's the idea was, if you had it, it was giving your child carte blanche to be promiscuous. Right. So in the same way, if you're giving your child birth control for, I don't know, maybe they're like 14 and they have really bad periods and they're an athlete and they don't want to be dealing with that. Like, there's mm-hmm. like so many legitimate reasons to just like want to be, no, not having to deal with being disabled for a full week out of every
yeah,
month.
Yeah.
You know, that was talked about in at least the community I was in as being like giving your child a green light to go be sexually active. That was like, yep. you know, this was approval, tacit approval.
Right. As if like, and it's the HPV vaccine. It's not birth control. Like, as if as if pregnancy suddenly wasn't possible after you got the vaccine. So you like, this only rules out a disease.
All of it is like, teens should not be having sex, and I don't want to know about it if it's happening against their will, mm-hmm. or even with their will. Like, it's just like consent yeah. doesn't matter. You just don't want to know about it. Don't want to have to talk about it. And so, ruling out these like basic medical care options is the way to solve this.
Yeah. Which is just not how any of that works.
Ugh. I want to close by reading something from a friend of the pod, a person who went to Grove City with me, so grew up being pro-life, and who has, you know, they and their wife have used IVF to have kids. And this is their response to the original court ruling in Alabama 3 weeks ago. So this is from Jesse Littlejohn, who is the director of operations at More Like Presbyterians. My first thought is, well, I think several things simultaneously. One, outrage that we exist in a country that is operating so openly in white supremacy culture. This decision will impact BIPOC folks, queer people, and single birthing persons the most. This law has white, straight, cisgender, and male written all over it. Two, gratitude that my wife and I live in Maryland and that our IVF journey was not only supported but celebrated. And there was zero judgment for what we had to do with our remaining embryos after we were done having kids. Three, a sense of panic that rulings like this spread how long before it's not just regulated to Alabama. It's funny. I grew up in a pro-life culture and have always been pro-choice, pro-body, autonomy. The hypocrisy of the pro-life movement says that frozen embryos have more life and rights than someone, say, next Benedict, is so abysmal and a blatant misuse of scripture. Disposing of our embryos was difficult for us for one reason. We'd spent so much money paying for their storage over 4 years, the time between our kids, and had always agreed that after we were done, we'd donate them to science. Being told that we'd have to continue to pay when we were not in a position to do so, see us having two kids now, because they didn't have to use them yet, that choice was hard. So I guess this was in response to, like, when the ruling came out, there was a lot of question about, would you be able to discard your embryos when mm-hmm. you were done, or were you going to have to pay to keep them frozen forever under that ruling? It felt like such a waste. My wife getting pregnant took 5 years. We went through it. Miraculously, IVF took on the first try for both of our kids. After numerous failed IUIs, having PCOS, having scary complication after complication, getting to IVF, these pregnancies were practically anomalies. Who wouldn't want to study these embryos? And there were 16 of them. Having to dispose of them, knowing they had the potential to help understand fertility science a little more, was hard. We never thought of them as our kids. We joked about it. We would tell our friends our son had 17 siblings on ice, but we never truly saw the embryos as life. Without Sarah, without her care and willingness to house them, without her sacrifice of her body in numerous ways to these embryos, they would just be scientific popsicles. And yet no one talks about Sarah as the wife in all of this.
Yep. That's a good note to end on.
Yeah, I think so too. So thanks to Jesse for sharing that. And I don't know. I'm going to be paying attention to the Fifth Circuit because it's scary.
Yeah. It's looking bleak. And I'm really sorry for everyone who has to deal with all of that bullshit. This is your periodic reminder to get your pap smear, though. Check your Gebärmutter Hole for any anomalies. go to your gynecologist and tell them that, and they'll be like, you're what now?
Kieran's going to include a photo of the diagram in the show notes, and we will include all the coverage that we reviewed for this conversation before we sat down to record it.
Yes, there was a lot. It was a lot of research.
Yeah. It's a really interesting moment because everything is coming back to money and privacy and the actual rulings, and the like theological element of all of this has been discarded because no one's in agreement about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it has been fascinating to kind of see how the pro-life movement has sort of started to fray now mm-hmm. that they don't have the unifier of Roe. Now that they won, they're like kind of lost, which is a good reason for us to hope and to keep poking at things like this, because their next steps are even less popular than Roe. So
yeah, like the legal battle is like very dire, but the actual like popularity contest, like if it was taken to the voting public, does not work in their favor.
It does not bode well for them.
Just remember that Trump lost the popular vote, okay? That's all. Yeah. That's all I got.
Well, yes, that's a good, it's always a good thing to remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for listening to this episode. Be sure to share it and rate it and do all those things.
Hit us up if you have things you want us to be looking at or covering. Go follow us on TikTok. We're trying to be more active there these days until it gets banned, I guess.
God, we could do a whole thing on that. Anyway, we don't have time for that rant.
No,
if you're in Slack, you've seen my rant on it. If you're not in Slack, go join our Patreon and be in Slack so you can see my rant on it. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Kitchen Table Cult podcast. Our music is from the track Janet by the band The Heavens on their album Stenazzo. Our producer is Dave the Great. Our podcast is made possible by Patreon donations from listeners like you. To support us and join our community on Slack, check out patreon.com/kitchentablecultpod. Thanks for listening.